number three, which is the director's report, which looks like it's a full report.
We'll try to move through this as fast as we can, Mr. Chairman, Commissioners. And I will just start with a couple items, and then I'm going to call up staff. We have several follow-up items from our previous meeting that the Commission's requested, so we'll have staff bump through those as quickly as possible. I just wanted to mention that we're continuing our work on our diversity and inclusion plan. We've put more work into the plan and have a pretty good product right now. But one of the main things that's occurred is we are in the process of putting together our diversity working group or advisory group. We put out a call for people interested, and I was thrilled that 70 people from around the department, from top to bottom, put their names in the hat and provided a paragraph or two of why they thought diversity was important and why they would be interested in being on this advisory group. And we're looking at that now, kind of winnowing it down. And there's representation from all the regions and from all the different programs. And we should have that put in place here in the next couple weeks. So that's a real positive, and we'll continue to work in that area throughout, well, from now on, or continue as we have been. And also, just we have an EMT sponsor for that group. It's going to be Amy Windrope. But this is going to be a self-directed group. And once they get going, they will make a decision on if they want to have an EMT sponsor, how they want to have leadership involved, or if they would like to have outside facilitation and shape the group that as they see fit in order to deal with some of the issues revolving around reluctance to report and those sorts of things. So we're looking for a lot of latitude for this group to be self-directed. The other item I guess I'll just mention is we had a Centennial Accord meeting a couple of weeks ago, and I thought it went really well. Something different this year than has occurred in the past. We had a natural resources meeting on the day prior to the regular Centennial Accord meeting, and that provided a whole bunch more time for us to work on natural resource issues. Some of the main important issues that came up from our standpoint, we had a good discussion on co-management of salmon and our interactions in the North of Falcon process with the tribes. That was a good discussion. We talked at length about hatcheries and the possibility of increasing hatchery production within ESA limits. The tribes are very interested in that, and our fish program has been working on that. We're investigating where that may be possible. We're also fund limited, so it was a good opportunity, I think, for the governor's office to hear the interest of the tribes and the state in an area where we have a lot of agreement. And so that was a good stroke. The other item that received considerable discussion was the Atlantic salmon release that occurred in August. And so we talked about that. We talked about the response. There was some question. Recently, we provided a permit to the aquaculture company to repopulate a different net pan with smolts. And also provided them a permit to bring eggs in to their freshwater facility here in Washington. The department's role is on fish health and permitting transportation. So we were required to, if they met their requirements, we met our obligation of providing those permits. There was certainly a lot of discussion. Several of the tribes would like to see no industry whatsoever. I think that there will be a pretty big debate this legislative session, and I am sure that the aquaculture industry and others will defend their their industry and programs, and I think there will be a good open policy debate in the legislature, and it'll be interesting to watch that and follow up. Our role, of course, will be to provide scientific information and background as best we can. I know there's some interest within the commission of getting more information on that, and so we'd like to provide the information to the commission soon. Also, we have put together a small white paper with some of the scientific information or background on Atlantic salmon aquaculture, and we can provide that at this point, but I think a good discussion in the commission would be an appropriate way to spend some time. And with that, I think I'm going to go ahead and ask some folks to come up, and I want you all to move very quickly through your assigned parts of this. And first, I think we'll start with Nate. And Donnie, why don't you go ahead and come up so you'll be up here. We'll give them the three-minute shepherd's hook, too, but they can move through some important issues. Nate's going to talk to us a little bit about our proviso obligations to the legislature and the progress we're making. And Nate, will you introduce some...
Excuse me, Director. Yeah.
Jim, I'm sorry. Can we back up just a sec?
You bet.
As far as the commission discussion about the net pens, how do you foresee that coming? I'm sure the Fish Commission or committee's all over it, but personally, I would like to weigh in a little on it, and I just was wondering when and how the opportunity would avail itself.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, Commissioner, I'll defer to Commissioner Baker because I know she has, we've discussed it, she has would like to put in a blue sheet, and I think there would be a time to discuss it more on how that's shaped. But.
Commissioner, I have a blue sheet that I'll be presenting tomorrow afternoon. Also, I've talked extensively to Ron Warren. Apparently, this isn't going to require a whole lot of extra staff work because they've already done the work. So what I've asked is that we have a commission discussion on this in December and then decide whether there's anything for us to decide at that time.
Okay. So that's okay. Thank you.
So I guess more discussion on the blue sheet later when it's presented. But okay, with that, Nate, go ahead and will you,
Director?
Oh, sorry, I'm not paying attention.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, Director Unsworth. Just one more question on your opening remarks. You mentioned increased hatchery production and some discussion with the tribes. Is that in the Puget Sound area only, or does that include the Columbia River? And do you see that there are any opportunities or any gaps currently existing for increased hatchery production within the ESA constraints that are there at the moment?
Well, at that forum, most people were interested in Puget Sound production and to see if there's any windows to increase that production. But I think that in the Columbia River, with our the Mitchell Act hatcheries and the rollbacks that we've had there, I think that we need to challenge and talk to NOAA about what may be possible. So one of the things that's occurring now is our response to this low abundance of killer whales that we're seeing in the Puget Sound and with the southern populations. And one of the things that we could do to respond to that problem would be to increase salmon production. I mean, that's one of the quickest things we could possibly do. And so I think that the for NOAA and NAMPS, that they need to we need to talk about where we're at with Mitchell Act production and some of those impacts up and down the coast, and maybe accept the fact that we ought to have a timeline discussion on some of those hatcheries and some of the the PHAS issues in our streams, and what's the real priority for those salmon populations. So.
One more, Director.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd just like to go on the record, Director, that I think we should really look at this with a broad overview. I think we need to look at any opportunities statewide, Columbia River, Coast, and Puget Sound, where we have reasonable opportunity to increase hatchery production. We talked at the meeting we had yesterday that the very, very significant declines in hatchery production as it relates to Chinook and coho, a huge driver for many, many fisheries in the state. So I'd like to be pretty forthright in looking at the big picture.
Yeah, thank you. It's, you know, the reduction in production is a combination of things. It's not just ESA limitations. There's some real dollar limitations that are provided to the reduced production in some of our systems. And so that's the analysis I think we need to do right now, is what is the gap between fulfilling our ESA restrictions and what's the potential for more production, and then what's the dollar value of that, and where could that funding come from? And that's why I was excited to have the governor's office here, that there, this is an area where we can agree with the tribes and that we ought to investigate. So,
I think now we can go back to you guys.
Thank you.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the Commission, Director Unsworth. Just wanted to provide an update regarding our performance review that's required in a proviso in this biennium's operating budget. It has three main components. The first is the legislature wanted us to do an organization and management assessment. We put out a competitive bid process for proposals and secured a matrix consulting group to help us with this effort. I think Alan Pennington is the principal, and he's in the back. He can wave. He's been doing, and his team has been doing a number of interviews. We've been providing them a bunch of information about how we operate, budget information, HR information, central service performance issues for the team to review. And certainly he's going to be wanting to interview all of you. And I think a number of you have had interviews lined up over the next couple days. So, his report, the legislature asked for this to be done by next May, and we moved up the timeline. And so the commission will actually be hearing the presentation on his findings at the December meeting, and then we'll hopefully have a work session in January with the legislature. And really, we wanted to do this early so that we could take advantage of any of the efficiencies found, as well as be able to inform our budget packages for next spring rolling into the 2019 session. The second component of the proviso is for us to conduct an outreach plan leading into the development of a long-term revenue plan to secure financial stability for the department. We've established a budget and policy advisory group consisting of members from rec and commercial fishing sectors, hunting groups, conservation groups, business and forestry, and ag interest. Really exciting. You know, the department has a number of different advisory groups, and to my knowledge, at least in the past decade that I've been with the department, we've never had an advisory group of this diversity and this many sectors brought together to help us on budget and policy matters. So it'll be a really useful body to take information to them and get their feedback on what are the services we're providing, how are we doing in terms of aligning our funding, and in particular, are there enhancements or areas that the public would like to see the department do more of? And so that, again, will inform our budget package development next spring and summer. We also submitted a request for proposals to hire a facilitator to help us with that advisory group. Just this week, we signed a contract with Ross Strategic, and our first meeting with this advisory group is on December 6th. And I will send that information to you all in case you're interested in attending. The meeting will be here in Olympia. We've also initiated outreach with tribal co-managers. Just this week, Jim Woods and I met with leadership from the Northwest Indian Fish Commission, and next week we're going to be meeting with the Upper Columbia United Tribes to see how they would like to engage on some of these issues, in particular on the kind of the zero-based budgeting, which is a third component of the proviso, and it is not as much fun as it sounds, admittedly. This is where we're doing a comprehensive review of the core activities that are required by statute statute for the department to engage in and look at the different funding sources available to us. And then the proviso has a series of very prescriptive elements that we need to analyze and provide feedback to the legislature on regarding how we're doing in terms of performance. Is there opportunities to repurpose funding into a higher priority area? And then ultimately, again, is there opportunities to pursue enhancements if there's areas that we're essentially we're required to do, but we don't have sufficient funding to meet those performance metrics? So, you know, I've been providing a standing update to you on kind of the process of how we're going about this proviso for the past few months. I think this is my last update in terms of process, and I'm eager and excited that starting in December, we'll be bringing you content and substance with the management review report, but also looking for your opportunities to engage on the long-term revenue plan and the zero-based budget analysis.
Question. Thank you, Nate. I think we've all read the proviso, and my guess is we all have our meetings with Mr. Matrix set up. The question that I have, the proviso is long and not just a little bit confusing. Can you tell us very succinctly the question that you asked the consultant to answer? In other words, what are we going to be asked in these meetings? Just so that we can give a little thought to it before we get there.
Mr. Chairman, Commissioner Baker, that's a great question. I'm thinking about the primary tasks that we've asked Matrix to look at. I believe in the interviews with you all, it's really going to be about management and accountability. I think will probably be the main focus of the questions that they'll be interested in getting your feedback on. That is one component of this portion of the proviso and the review. Others talk about, you know, whether or not we should have a more centralized budget or not. How are we doing in terms of IT and HR resources, our business services, our contracts and financial management? So those are components that we've asked Matrix to engage on, but I don't think that they'll be asking you those specifics.
Thank you.
And I think I had my interview. You had yours.
I did too, yeah.
Okay. Anybody have theirs already? So just the two of us.
I mean, I thought it went very well. I thought it was open dialogue and a good exchange, and came away comfortable with the process, Mr. Baker.
It was about 35 minutes, and it was good.
Mr. Chairman, we've talked with lots of people have had interviews, and I'm impressed with Alan and his Matrix staff and how willing they are to get back to you. So if you think of things that you've forgotten, I know that you could call and tell them about from the interview standpoint. So,
yeah, one question.
And thanks for the presentation. My question has to do with timing of commission activity on this. So you've indicated that you'll be coming back under the director's report regularly on matters of substance. In terms of when any of this would come before the commission for any decision making, as opposed to just briefings of how things are going, you mentioned for the organization and management assessment sometime next spring, the long-term revenue plan, I don't recall what you said, and the zero-based budget analysis. Looking back at agenda item 16 at our year at a glance, the long-term revenue plan shows up in April and the zero-based budgeting in September, budget and legislative packages in August. And I know that's a very tentative skeletal test of a year at a glance exercise, but when would you think that there would be commission agenda items that would get to these, and in particular reference to if the zero-based budgeting matter is where there would be some prioritizing exercises that the commission would go through.
Mr. Chairman, Commissioner McIsaac, just to orient you on the timelines again and then maybe look at those opportunities for commission engagement. The proviso requires the organization assessment to be submitted next May. We're moving that up in January, and the commission will have a presentation and opportunity to engage with Matrix on those recommendations at the December meeting. The long-term revenue plan is due on May 1st to the legislature. What we've envisioned and eager to work with you all on thinking about how to structure this is a series of, you know, two-plus hour workshops this winter. I'm thinking in particular January, March, and April meetings where we can present to you our thinking on how we're dividing up the agency into major activities and sub-activities and looking at funding. So that's that zero-based budget piece. Start bringing to you, first, let's talk about your all's values on how we try to achieve financial security and stability for the department, and then look at what are those revenue options that we can work with our new budget and policy advisory group to develop and bring you those recommendations. So, again, I see a series of meetings this winter where we're devoting some time for the commission to have a robust discussion about your values and your principles and what it is that you would like to see from the department. The zero-based budgeting piece, that work will be done this winter. The fall timeline is just when it's due, and it will be accompanying our operating and capital budget request for the 2019-21 biennium that's submitted in September.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. One follow-up. You mentioned the Upper Columbia tribes or something like that in your consultations on, I think, the zero-based budget. Could you elaborate on that and why them?
Yeah, so we're reaching out to the three primary consortiums of tribes within Washington, the Northwest Indian Fish Commission, the Columbia River Intertribal Commission, and the Upper Columbia United Tribes. As indicated, we met with Northwest Indian Fish Commission earlier this week, meeting with Upper Columbia United Tribes next week, and we tried to reach out with CRTFIC. We just haven't lined up a meeting yet, but that's on the to-do list. Upper Columbia United Tribes, there's a series of executive order tribes, but the Colville does have off-reservation hunting and fishing rights, and we're certainly engaged with them on a variety of matters, ranging everything from FCRPS, Federal Columbia River Power System Management, wildlife mitigation, and hunting and fishing opportunities.
Nate, you were talking about having some of your commission discussions this winter. February is right in the heart of my calving, so I will not be at the February meeting, so I hopefully you can get it one side or the other so it isn't all just done on the February meeting, because this is something that really interests me.
Mr. Chairman, Commissioner Holzmiller, yes, thank you. I don't think the commission has the meeting in February. I think it's January, March, and April that we'll try to.
No, it's generally because I always miss the February meeting.
Yep. Okay.
So.
Thanks. Okay.
You're done?
Okay. Thank you, Nate. Thanks for the update. Donnie?
Commission, Director Unsworth, thank you. And just give you a quick update on wolf conservation and management, mainly focusing on wolf-livestock interactions and the implementation of our most recent protocol. Wanted to touch on that this year's protocol is not just about lethal removal. It's about the full interactions between wolves and livestock, so it's also about the non-lethal deterrent tools that we work with producers upon the landscape. We worked with dozens and dozens of producers this year to implement a variety of different non-lethal deterrents that are custom to those operations. It was probably our best year in terms of coverage of use of range riders, both contracted range riders and others, on allotment settings, and so we've really made some progress in that. In terms of conflict depredations by wolves on livestock, we had about four areas of the state where we had documented wolf depredations on livestock. We took action, lethal removal action, in two packs. Of course, you're aware of that. In the smackout pack, we removed two wolves after reaching the criteria in our plan and our protocol. And that final report is now complete and online for that removal action in the smackout pack. We have had one additional depredation after the removal, but it doesn't appear that it's an ongoing pattern. I'll come back to that in a moment. The other pack where we conducted lethal removals in the Sherman pack, again, after meeting the criteria in the plan and the protocol, we removed one wolf from that pack. We haven't documented any further depredations by that pack since then. In both of those packs, we, as per the protocol, at least one of the criteria is how many depredations over a period of time, either 3 in 30 days or 4 in 10 months. Both of those packs are in a situation where we're in a 10-month window and there's 3 documented depredations. If there's another depredation in either one of those packs, we'll again go through all the criteria in the protocol and the plan and assess whether it would initiate lethal removal again. And those, I won't give the exact dates here, but those, that 10-month window for both of those takes us into next spring. Switching gears to the WAG process. So just be a little forthright here, a little embarrassed by it. It's taken us, me, quite a long time to fill the vacancies on WAG. We have, I believe, 4 or 5 vacancies right now that we're filling. We're wrapping that process up in the next few weeks, and we'll be onboarding folks this fall onto WAG and then scheduling the next WAG meeting likely in December or January. And the last thing related to WAG is, over the past couple of years, a lot of the discussion in WAG, they've touched a lot of things, but one of the bigger items has been wolf-livestock conflict. We'd like to move on to some other important issues, and so one of the topics that WAG will be talking about at their upcoming meeting is wolf management in the next 5 or 10 years, really maybe a post-delisting wolf conservation management. So still wolf-livestock conflict, a very important variable of wolf conservation management, but we do see on the horizon that we're getting closer and closer to our delisting objectives, so it's time to start planning and thinking about that. That's all I have. If you have any questions.
Thank you, Donnie. Yes.
No.
The range rider first.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Donnie, I know a lot of the work in conflict avoidance occurs during the grazing season when the cattle are out on large allotments and the need for range riders. The point you made about being at 3 depredations in a 10-month window makes you think back to, okay, you know, in Montana and Idaho, they have depredations over winter, you know, not as much as out on the range, but they do. And I just wondered if our conflict specialists out in the field lines and trying to gear up and continuing to work with those producers back in calving situations and whatnot, especially when just one more depredation could move the decision towards lethal. Is there some meetings or at least some conceptual ideas of what they're going to be doing with producers over winter?
There is. It's a great point. Most of our packs, if not all of them, do overlap private lands that have livestock and they're there year-round or maybe come off the allotment range and are on private ground through the winter months. We typically see most depredations and most conflict during the summer months when there's more proximity between wolves and livestock, but it can happen and has happened before. So the answer to the question is yes, our conflict staff work with producers year-round. It's a 24/7 job throughout the calendar year. And continuing that vigilance with deterrent tools and techniques and stuff.
And he did raise a very salient point. I was talking to a fellow about just that fact yesterday, and that's what he was, just because they come off the allotments doesn't mean that it's over and done with. And one thing too, Donnie, I can't encourage you enough to keep looking over the horizon where we're headed, because yeah, there's going to be issues that we need to talk about that aren't going to be all that touchy-feely. And the quicker we address them, the better off we're going to be. And to this point in time, we haven't heard a lot of concern from the hunting community, and hopefully we don't. But if we do, if this discussion is going on, I think that will help quell some of that. So just can't encourage you enough to keep looking over the horizon, because it isn't if, hopefully that day will come sooner than later and we won't be standing there with their teeth, their mouth going, now what do we do? So attaboy, keep going at it.
Thank you. Agreed. Thank you.
Thanks, Donnie.
Okay, thank you. Joe's going to give an update on the Elwha land ownership, and while he's doing that, Michelle, Kelly, and Eric, why don't you all come up so you're ready?
Yeah, good morning, Commissioners. One of the themes you'll see in this agenda is an emphasis on follow-up to public comment that occurred at your last meeting. So I wanted to just touch on a couple of of issues, just to let you know that we did do some follow-up. A member of the public, Mrs. Dean, had come forward and was concerned about firearm use in a residential area, and so we asked our regional wildlife manager, Brian Calkins, to contact Mrs. Dean, which she did, and they discussed the overlay between county firearm restrictions with the state rules and the firearm restrictions that reside there. And we're going to work with Mrs. Dean to do some more outreach to our hunters to make them aware of you know, where there are sensitivities around residential areas, and then look at how we set those restrictions up in the future. So there was some resolution there. And then, as the director said, we had a Mr. Ed Bowen testify, and he was interested in two things. First, he wanted the state, whoever that might be, to indicate an interest in some federal property that was related to the Elwha River Restoration Project. And he wasn't particular about which agency, but he was asking us to look into it. So Julie Sandberg, our real estate division manager, contacted several times the deputy superintendent for the Olympic National Park. She got a hold of some maps of the specific properties in question. She heard that they don't want to own this mix of public-private properties into perpetuity, so they're looking for some kind of path forward. And so Julie was going to take a look at those properties and, you know, what might make sense for the Department of Fish and Wildlife and put some recommendations forward. So you'll probably be hearing more about that in the future. And then the second issue that Mr. Bowen brought forward was a boat launch property that he believes we own. And that boat launch operated on Lake Aldwell, which was one of the lakes that doesn't exist anymore since the removal of the dams drained it. So she's been verifying property ownership, discussing the situation internally, and is going to prepare a response to Mr. Bowen. It appears that Clallam County deeded the land to us specifically for a public boat launch, and now that it's kind of high and dry, but it's still actively used for access to the lake bed, recreational access, people walking around and hiking. So we'll have some more discussion about you know, with Clallam County and others about what to do with that boat ramp property. So more to come on both of those.
Thanks. Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Michelle, are you going to start out with our halibut update?
Good morning, Chairman Smith and Commissioners and Director Unsworth. I just wanted to give a brief follow-up. There were some halibut questions and some testimony that was presented to you at your meeting in Port Angeles. And I apologize if this is old news to some of you, but we do have some new commissioners that I wanted to make sure I oriented everyone to halibut management. So halibut are managed by the International Pacific Halibut Commission. And you might hear us refer to Area 2A. Area 2A is the west coast down here of Washington, Oregon, and California. That's a Halibut Commission regulatory area. The center of distribution for Pacific halibut is up here in the Bering Sea and Aleutian Islands. And so we are really here at the tail end of the range of the halibut stock. So oftentimes you will hear some questions or comments relative to why does the West Coast or Area 2A get a relatively small portion of the total, and the answer to that question is because we really are at the tail end of the stock. This is a management overview of the process, and so on the left-hand side is what goes into the pre-season setting process. So again, if you think about this perhaps in the terms of an annual salmon season process or the North of Falcon process, we have an annual season setting process for halibut. Instead of March and April, though, those meetings occur in September and November. So WDFW, down at the bottom left-hand corner, we play more of an advisory role, and we are the entity that solicits the stakeholder input from recreational commercial fishers. And we develop recommendations that we then provide to the Pacific Fishery Management Council. And those recommendations are relative to the following year's season, any proposed changes we would make into the West Coast sharing of that quota that we're assigned by the Halibut Commission, and coordination with the West Coast states, National Marine Fisheries Service, and the tribes relative to fisheries. Those recommendations, if approved by the council, then move forward up to the Halibut Commission. And the Halibut Commission is responsible for conservation of the stock, biology, and research. They do an annual survey, an annual stock assessment. And then each year in January, they set those annual catch quotas for all of those regulatory areas that I displayed on the map previously. So they also have an oversight approval role relative to the catch sharing plan, so how we share the allocation that's assigned to us on the West Coast, and the management structure that we have in place to ensure accurate catch accounting and adherence to those quotas. So then moving over to the right side of this graphic, once those quotas are set, then in season, as we move forward with the halibut fishery, the Halibut Commission provides management oversight. National Marine Fisheries Service adopts rules and federal regulations to implement that catch sharing plan and ensure that we have good catch accounting protocols in place on the West Coast. And then our agency adopts conforming rules. And so the process that we go through for that, the commission has delegated the authority to the director to adopt those rules, primarily because all of the public involvement process has already taken place prior to the time the department is in the rulemaking process, and really we just adopt regulations that conform to the federal regulations that have already been adopted. We then have port sampling efforts along the coast and in Puget Sound to do that catch accounting role, and then we coordinate with the states of Oregon and California, and we also have an enforcement role relative to those fisheries. This just gives you a snapshot on where halibut catch sharing is relative to the West Coast. So starting up at the top, that is what our quota was in 2017, is 1.33 million pounds. Through a federal court order, in this case, our sharing with the treaty tribes, the tribes get 35%. So folks are most familiar with U.S. v. Washington and the Bolt decision, where the tribes get 50% of the harvestable resource. Through a separate federal court order, the tribes get 35% of the halibut resource. That's the amount that is deemed to pass through their usual and accustomed fishing areas. So that initial sharing occurs between the tribes and the non-tribal fisheries, and then you'll see there within the non-tribal fisheries, then it's shared with a directed commercial fishery and then sport fisheries in Washington, Oregon, and California. And then the graphic off to the right shows that tribal 35%, and then shows we have the commercial fishery at 19%, Washington sport at 23%, Oregon sport at 20%, and California at 3%. So just to orient you to the process and where we are currently where the department finished its October public meeting. So we had an initial public meeting in August where we met with recreational harvesters primarily, but also with commercial interests. And solicited any input, any proposed changes they would have for the seasons for 2018. We brought those forward to the Pacific Council at their meeting in mid-September. We had a second public meeting in October to get further input on those alternatives that went out for public review. And then we have submitted a report to the Pacific Council summarizing the recommendations from those meetings that we had, and I'll get into those specifics in my next slide. So from there, the Pacific Council would take final action at their meeting in November. Again, that's in the form of recommended changes for 2018. They would bring those forward to the Halibut Commission for approval. And the Halibut Commission will have an interim meeting in late November. That's in Seattle. And that's where they give us a preview of the results of their survey this year and their stock assessment, and kind of a preseason forecast, if you will, for next year of what they think the quotas may be looking like. And then they have their annual meeting in late January that will be in Portland, Oregon next year. And that's where they will set the quotas for 2018 and the seasons. So this is my last slide. This is what we put forward to the Pacific Council for recommendations for 2018. I will say we had a fairly large turnout at our meeting. We had about 65 recreational representatives there. We had a few representatives from the salmon troll fishery, a couple representatives from the sablefish primary fishery, and we had representatives from the Northwest Indian Fisheries Commission, the Macaw, Quinault, and Ho tribes. So recommendations for 2018, the first one is to continue this common season approach that we had in place in 2017 for the South Coast, which is our Area 2, our Marine Area 2 that's based in Westport, the North Coast, which are the ports of La Push and Nia Bay, and then throughout Puget Sound. And one of the main sticking points of consensus of the group there was to stick with the allocations that we have in that catch sharing plan. So the allocations that I displayed previously with that pie chart, they wanted to make sure that those remained in place for 2018. The one change that we're proposing to allocation is with regard to the sablefish incidental fishery. So right now they have a maximum amount that's set aside for them of 70,000 pounds, up to 70,000. They are recommending reducing that to 50,000, which would free up 20,000 that would go back to the Washington sport fishery. So this is a proposal that the primary sablefish fishermen put forward as a compromise proposal to the council in September. And it has strong support by everyone, and actually Fishing Vessel Owners Association, Bob Alverson, has already submitted a letter of public comment supporting that. So in the history of the sablefish fishery, they have not ever taken more than 50,000 pounds. So by capping themselves at 50,000, when the quotas at where it has been about 1.5 million pounds or less, they're pretty much accommodating what they need for incidental, and then they're freeing up that 20,000 to come back for our sport fishing opportunity. For the Columbia River area, this is an area that we share with Oregon. So this runs from Leadbetter Point, Washington, south to Cape Falcon, Oregon, that we share as a common area. And they're proposing for their area that's currently open Thursday through Sunday to drop Saturday and to be open Thursday, Friday, and Sunday. And with that change, they're hoping that that will extend their season a little bit further in time. So in the past, they've had seasons that have been 40, 50 days long. This last year, their season was 14 days long. So they're just looking to extend that season a little bit further through the months of May and June. And then we were able to reach a pretty much general consensus on the proposed dates for 2018 for that common season. So we have selected the dates that you see there. We handed out a series of tide charts for May and June, taking into account what's the best, safest tides that could be available, looking at providing weekend opportunities, and then sprinkled with a couple weekdays, but making sure there's only like one day off in between, so folks are more encouraged to stay within a port and go fishing perhaps for the following opener as well. And so again, these are dates that we're proposing. We'll bring these forward to the council. Once the council approves them, then we will post them on our website as preliminary dates so as to give the public some adequate notice and time for advance planning for next year. So with that, I'd be happy to take any questions.
Mr. Chair, thanks, Michelle, for the good summary and the follow-up from the Port Angeles meeting. I commend you and your staff for going through this exercise. It put a lot of time and effort. I'm sure not everybody is happy with the outcome, but I don't think anybody can question the open and public process that the department went through in trying to get this. So that's my comment. My question is, you know, I understand how contentious halibut allocations are coastwide. And you pointed out that if you look, California, their recreational fishery might get its fair share, if it depends on who you ask. But so I guess my question is, and concern is, by this relatively small shift of the commercial harvest to the recreational harvest in our state, are we potentially opening up Pandora's box, and now we're going to have a huge food fight within the commission, within the council, as far as who gets what, and potentially go backward as far as Washington is concerned? Is that a concern or no?
Thank you for the question. Hopefully not. So we have been, I'll say we've been having a friendly food fight for the last couple of years. California has raised for the each year for the last couple of years the desire to increase their allocation from the 3% of where it is. They have been looking primarily at the Washington sport fishery and Oregon sport fishery to potentially contribute more to their sport fishery. California had in the past 1% allocation, and a couple years ago both Oregon and Washington gave up each 1% to get California to 3%. And to put that into perspective, that 3% provides the California sport fishery with a season that lasts about 4 months long, compared to the 4 or 5 day seasons we have off of Washington and Oregon. So from that perspective, I think the council has had good deliberations and discussions about the fairness question in terms of the opportunity that's being afforded in each of those states. And by focusing on the sablefish incidental amount, that's actually a portion that comes out of the Washington sport fishery. And so because of that, it's really just moving fish around within the Washington pie, if you will, and not necessarily opening up Pandora's box. And California at the September meeting made it clear that they were not at this time going to move forward with any proposed allocation shifts for the next couple of years. So they're as satisfied as they could be with their 3% at this point.
This is confirming my recollection. One of the things that we heard in Port Angeles was that they, many of the testifiers wanted a bag limit, basically, a season limit, and they wanted that to sort of dictate the season, which would have opened it up. At the meeting in Elma, it seemed to me that we came up with a 4 fish per person limit. Is that one of the recommendations? That's question number one. And then the second question, which is related, because this is an issue that Commissioner Graybill is very interested in, is there was a lot of talk about catch record accounting and how to do it more in real time. I wondered if that's something that you're going to keep working on.
Yes, thank you. So apologize for that. I think you have copies of the report that were provided to you, and so we do include a recommendation for an annual bag limit of 4. We looked at putting in a bag limit anywhere from 2 to 6 fish and thought 4 was a good starting point as taking an initial step, getting folks used to having an annual bag limit, which we haven't had before in this fishery. So apologize for not including that on the slide of recommendations. And then relative to the catch record card, I think that's a discussion that we'll be looking at further through some of the conversations that Nate will be having, and looking at how do we structure our recreational licenses in the future and the catch record card system in that.
Another issue that we heard in Port Angeles was the concern about safety with the season days. And you said that there was considerable input into selecting these dates. Do these dates help with that at all, that issue of safety?
Thanks. So weather is very unpredictable, and so we tried our best to pick the most favorable tides. So particularly for smaller boats, looking at a tidal exchange that isn't very large, and using that as kind of our initial. And then the first bullet that's here, that's relative to those different sub areas retaining their allocations. And so one of the questions that came up was, let's say there's really bad weather or poor fishing conditions off our northern coast, off of Nia Bay and Lepush. But let's say there's more favorable fishing conditions inside waters in Puget Sound that are a little bit more protected, or further south off of Westport. By maintaining those area specific allocations, basically, if a sub area gets weathered out and there's poor opportunity, then their assigned quota carries them forward to the next fishing day. So they'll get an opportunity, if you will, to keep their quota and make up that fishing day, just jumping to the next season date that's available.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thanks for the very nice presentation. It's great to see things like agenda item E1A so professionally put together as it normally has been in the past. A question about the season dates, and I'll say again some of the testimony we heard in Port Angeles, which was a lot over and over again about halibut. Some of the folks were interested in a little bit earlier time than May. For maybe the eastern part of the straits. And so I wondered if you could show your process slide there. And as this moves forward and you get to January and the IPHC meeting is over, and you know, this is all excellent planning for a total of 1.5 million pounds for Area 2A. But if there's a shock and it's only 1 million, or there's another shock and it's 2 million, or something like that, maybe these dates are either too generous or not generous enough. And so the question is, when do these dates actually get solidified? Looking at the process thing, it looks like after January, adopt rules for and announce season dates. You mentioned tentatively putting them on the website early. And the folks there were asking the commission to weigh in on the season dates. So I presume in your public meeting in Montesano that you heard from everybody. It's not clear to me that, based on what we heard in Port Angeles, that everybody would have not liked to see something a little bit earlier. So are these the dates that are, I mean, if the commission says nothing else, this goes to the council, this runs through, and if there's 1.5 million pounds at IPHC, I presume these will be the dates. The commission will not weigh in on this again. Or is there some other time when the commission would weigh in on these dates?
Thank you for the question. So as we noted here, we would post our preliminary season dates on the website after the November council meeting, assuming that those dates move forward. We characterize those dates on our website as being preliminary, and that in all cases, the sub-areas are continued to be quota managed. So they're managed in season. And basically, the announcement of season dates is for people to plan to make reservations ahead of time, but depending on where the quotas are set in January, it may be that a given sub-area will likely only get the first four dates, or the first five dates, if you will. So for planning purposes, those are typically where we're able to hone in on the season dates a little bit more after the IPHC meeting in January. But these would be the prescribed dates going forward. So assuming that there's sufficient quota available, a sub-area would be open starting on May 11th and then moving forward through these dates, provided there is sufficient quota. And once that sub-area has reached its quota, then it would close, but other sub-areas could remain open for the next scheduled fishing date if they still have quota left. So typically the commission does not get involved in setting season dates. We typically do have these annual stakeholder meetings of where there's a lot of give and take amongst the different ports and sub-areas. There's scheduled fishing derbies. There's other scheduled events that are happening in communities that we try to accommodate as well. And there's a lot of back and forth amongst the stakeholders that are there. Usually the department doesn't really weigh in on our choice of season dates. We just make it clear that we will be available to sample the fishery and monitor it whenever it's open.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a follow-up so I understand it then, and this is not a noticed public comment decision agenda item for halibut dates, so it would not be appropriate for the commission to offer any alternatives. But so the season dates are really set by this public meeting process in Montesano, unless something at the council meeting comes up that they look far too generous and would hurt the quota. That's the way to understand this?
Yes.
We are running a little late here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My apologies. That should have been a regular agenda item. There's lots of interest there. I should have anticipated that. So, Kelly and Eric, you guys move quickly because we're going to have Ron come up and talk about crab.
And we're not going to take a formal break. We're just going to, so just okay. Break as you need. So,
thank you, Director Unsworth and Chairman Smith and fellow commissioners. This is an update on the Douglas PUD transition from a WDFW operation to Douglas PUD. As you're aware, Douglas PUD issued a termination clause in our agreement, a 90-day clause, which ends November 28th. We're continuing to work with them collaboratively on a transition plan and an MOU for the remaining time in the contract. They have hired their entire staff, which will start somewhere around November 1st to November 6th. All of the staff came from WDFW with the exception of one. So they've hired a lot of our staff away from us. One of the things that's some sticking issues that are still out there are around ESA coverage, pathology, and disposition of surplus and or fish that are in excess of program. So we're still working through those with the utility. And one of the things you're going to see in the next item for land acquisition is a transfer of property that is in WDFW ownership only during the duration that we operate the facilities. And so it's where the houses are at Wells Hatchery. So it's an update. I'll take any questions if you have any.
Okay. Morning, Chair Smith, members of the Commission. Wanted to take an opportunity and provide you an update on the guide proviso that we received. Nate mentioned the management assessment or the organizational assessment proviso and the zero-based budget proviso. Our operating budget also included a guide proviso. You recall in Port Angeles, you heard some public testimony, and we provided you an update about our implementation plan, which at the time included two public meetings that the legislature directed us to, and in addition included a survey to capture the voices of other folks who were not able to attend those two meetings. Since that meeting in Port Angeles, we got a lot of feedback from the public, a lot of requests to expand our public meetings. We listened to those requests. Commissioner Grayville weighed in supporting those requests, and we've added an additional four meetings. So we will be, in addition to the Forks meeting and the Lyle meeting, we'll be in Ridgefield on November 9th, Mill Creek November 3rd, in East Wenatchee on the 20th of November, and over in Clarkston on the 21st. Commissioner Carpenter mentioned the meeting in Forks on Wednesday. That was our kickoff meeting. We're using these meetings to address other issues, so any fisheries management issues. The other issue that's on the minds of the guides these days is the fee increase that was a part of our budget as well. We had over 90 members of the public at that meeting, including Senator Vandaway and County Commissioner, and Commissioner Baker attended as well. I think it was a good meeting. We got a lot of good feedback from the public. We got a lot of good suggestions on what we should include in our report back to the legislature, which is due on the 31st of December. So in the spirit of trying to get folks back on track, I'll stop there and take any questions that you all may have.
Now, you said you're having a meeting in Clarkston?
Yes, Commissioner Holzmiller. November 21st, 6 to 8 p.m. at the Walla Walla Community College. November 21st.
Have you had enough input yet to determine whether this is sort of a river by river? Are there issues that are kind of river by river, or I mean, is this going to be doable with all of these meetings?
Great question, Commissioner Thorburn. I think that if you back up to the last legislative session, the concern was primarily on the Olympic Peninsula, coastal streams, and the Klickitat River. As you can imagine, guides across the state have some concern about policy creep. There are guides, for example, in Clarkston who guide on the OP. So when we start talking about things like limited entry, they become concerned. So I think we're going to hear a wide variety of comments, a wide variety of suggestions, and it's our task to wrap all of that up into a bow and provide the legislature with what we've heard. It's not going to be an easy task. It's a very short timeline. All of this has to be done by December 31st, as I mentioned. But I think what we'll be able to provide the legislature is the kind of the general themes surrounding guiding in Washington, and at the very least what the guide community thinks should be done. I think we will be poised to respond to any future legislative actions as a result.
Good luck.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just quickly, you may have got to it with that last sentence. So in terms of some policy preference from the commission on these questions, I was going to ask, when would this come before the commission if the commission wanted to take a look at it? Maybe the commission doesn't. It's an agenda item discussion. You mentioned December 31st is a deadline, and then you said if there is legislation, then that would be the time for the commission to make a policy recommendation?
Thank you, Commissioner McIsaac. The timeline is short, the 31st. What we intend to do is share the draft of the report with the commission and with the guide community as well. I don't believe we're going to have an agenda item before December 31st, but we will definitely be. It's an ongoing conversation. The legislature will likely consider what we have to say and potentially direct us in the next legislative session. We'll be poised to respond to that and engage the commission with any additional legislative direction we have.
Yes.
Kelly, would it be fair to say that and what the legislature expects has to do with guiding on the Olympic Peninsula in the Kitsap, not Clickit Hat River, and what we're learning, though, could be applied to the guide and their preferences statewide for future action? Is the legislature just expecting us to provide them information or a recommendation on the Olympic Peninsula?
Thank you, Commissioner Graybill. The proviso is extremely broad. Okay. With respect to the Olympic Peninsula and the Klickitat River, they directed us to those two geographic locations for these public meetings based on what they were hearing from guides in those two locations,
right,
that helped draft the original bill.
Right.
However, the proviso activities beyond the meetings is contains a statewide scope, I would say.
Yes.
So we were directed to visit with guides across the state, not only guides, but also the angling public to answer a couple of questions that the legislature had around the guiding experience, the fishing experience, and what could be improved that would improve the experience, and what I will say what actions the state should take in regulating guides to support those experiences.
Right, and it seems like to my mind that we can make recommendations to the legislature specifically to Olympic Peninsula and the Klickitat River. Those were the concerns that brought this forward. Also, I think we could probably make recommendations in terms of regulation of the guide industry. That's been pointed out, I believe, at these meetings that we need to have some kind of regulations with teeth. But, you know, in the background, there's, you know, what format do we move forward with? We've talked about the Montana plan and the Idaho plan and how that's applied. It seems that we'd be premature to recommend that sort of a drastic change to our management of the guide industry within Washington at this point. But we're learning a lot through this process about what the industry prefers and also recreational anglers.
Correct.
So I just wanted to bring that up, that this has opened up a discussion for a much larger platform.
That's an excellent point, Commissioner Graybill. One of the things we are suggesting is, because we have a lot of questions about pressure.
Yes.
Where are guides guiding? How many trips are they taking? How many encounters per trip? So one of the things we're suggesting and working through with the guide community is establishing a logbook that would provide us a lot of the information that you just suggested we need in helping to formulate those recommendations. Yes.
Excellent. Thanks.
Is that it?
That's it. So, Ron, you want to go ahead on CRAP?
Thank you, Director. Chair Smith, Commissioners, Ron Warren, Fish Program. Earlier you heard testimony from Ron Garner. I can't dispute anything that he said. A very accurate testimony in that we are in deliberations with two East tribes that have UNA for crabbing in that particular area. That area is from Fidalgo Island inside or east of Woodby Island to the south tip of Woodby Island, or in a marine area aspect 8182. We are and do have ongoing conversations. The recent history of Two East is it's a fairly active area because of its geographic location, not only for recreational fishers but for commercial fishers. had a fairly high abundance in that area the last few years, although we've seen some minimal declines in that. All of us are concerned because of the sustainability of ongoing resources, of making sure we're watching that carefully. And but in an effort to achieve our share, and the tribes doing the same, tribes have a bit of a different value. So last year, here when we had our breach of our the security system for our license system, because of the lack of knowledge that the tribes had about our catch because of the 10 days or whatever that period was of kind of the free fishing period, they came off the water. They came off the water at the same time this year to hope that they could see the results of the pilot program that we had. We extensively creeled the crab fishery alongside our salmon fishery this year to run a verification of our catch record cards. That is not complete yet, probably won't be complete for another month or so. We have staff from both the state and Northwest Indian Fish Commission looking at that. Point is that right now we're about 100,000 pounds in front of the tribe. There's still plenty of share for both the state and the tribes to reach, and we believe there's sufficient crab to reach that quota at this time. We do have a conversation Monday. We will likely be bringing and have committed to bring the commercial fleet off the water November 1st or October 31st. And have conversations with the tribes on the other details of 2 weeks on Monday, and hope to bring this issue to a close, and can certainly provide the information at that time to the commission on the results of those deliberations. And if you have any questions, I'll try to answer them.
Then I was going to see if Ron, if you had any, the other round behind you.
Yeah.
go on. Go first.
Okay. Commissioner Kehoe's question, if you bring the commercials off, is there already in discussion plans about returning them to the water?
Yes. So we've been in conversations that we've had with the tribes is what their estimated catch per day is. Initial estimates will be about 7,000 pounds a day. Depending on effort in other areas and the effort that they get into East will determine how long that takes. But we are pushing to bring them back on no later than right around the 1st of December. That's what our desire is. Monday's conversations will determine the outcome, I believe. And just to add some, with the recreational fishery and its estimated catch, you know, we're talking about months of recreational opportunity. We're also talking about if the current crab price is held at over $4 a pound, that this fishery for the commercial fleet is worth over $5 million just in the next few months. So it's very important to us. It's very important to them. They have been very, very helpful. I've been in touch daily with the president of the Puget Sound Crab Association, who I had never met before this process. But a very professional individual, and I'm really enjoying getting to know him. So Brian Allison is his name, can't say enough for his knowledge of the industry and recommendations to the agency as an advisor and as an industry representative.
I had two parts. I think you answered one. I was going to ask about the economic ramifications. It's a significant hit, you know, on the commercial fleet, and that's bothersome. But I guess you'd also mentioned maybe I misunderstood you, that the potentially you have some slight concern about abundance drop off. and what that's, how that's going to affect. Now, if the tribes go in for 30 days and then the non-tribal commercials go in, where that's going to leave the abundance quantity.
Thank you, Commissioner Carpenter. I did not do a very good job in articulating what I was trying to get at. The abundance is that in our preseason deliberations of forecast and the development and signing of our crab agreements that we have, it has been that the Two East crab abundance has declined the last couple of years. Yes, there are concerns because of the number of pounds per day in the effort, those types of things, that some people believe that the abundance is lower than where we had set it. At this time, we are not seeing any of that from criteria that we use to measure the fishery to determine that the abundance is not what we believed it to be during the preseason discussions. However, as the season goes on, if we were to see a similar effort and people really starting to scratch for a daily catch of a particular limit, industry people and staff would be able to tell me what that limit is, we would then consider to say we might have some concern for the population and the sustainability of that population, but we don't have that right now.
Thank you.
So as I understand, the tribes stopped sort of on their own. Is there a communication issue here that can prevent this in the future? They were waiting for data from us or something like that is what I understood and just decided to stop.
Thank you, Commissioner Thorburn. You are correct. The decision not to fish in common with the state fishery is a tribal choice, and we have fished in this area for a long time together and hope to continue to fish into the future together, and believe we can. We have earlier this year. We hope to later this year as well.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You indicated that December 1 might be a time when the fleet could go back in. And is the winter season through the end of the year, or is the winter season through the end of March? And do you feel like if they did go back on December 1st, that they would be able to catch their allocation in accordance with the plan?
Thank you, Commissioner McIsaac. The current season schedule per agreement lasts through the middle of February, and we believe that we would be able to attain our share, and there's plenty of time to do that. Thank you.
And Ron, did you want to come up and
you might want to
follow up?
Hi, Ron.
Hi, Ron.
I guess my concerns are one would be if we have to come off the water, we get a commitment from the tribes what that date is we go back on, not an estimate, but a date, because right now it's a signed agreement we're going up against, we're breaking. So we need to have, number one, a signed agreement how long they're going to take, because they do have tribal exclusion zones on the north and south end that only they get to fish. They have held off because now Christmas is coming, Chinese New Year, the crab are going to be worth a lot more money. I mean, it's not that hard to see what's going on. You can see exactly what's going on. I didn't print the picture out, but I have a picture of a sign in a supermarket, $17.99 a pound, Dungeness crab, whole. $35 a crab, that's a lot of money. So I would like to, this pattern is just beginning to develop more and more on all of our fisheries, that now we're even going up and breaking signed agreements. And if this continues, we're going to be fishing whenever they let us. And that's what this is really about, is a power play. I'm in full disagreement of what's happening. We've worked on many fisheries together, and we work with a lot of the tribes, but there's a few of them. The Skokomish, for one, has been able to completely hold up anybody going on the Skokomish River They had 35,000 kings go back to the hatchery, to our hatchery, George Adams Hatchery, this year, 32,000 the year before, while we're not allowed on the river. Now, are we going to keep going down this precedented road that we're going to just keep moving out of the way when somebody doesn't want us there? Because that's what this is really all about, is how far can we be pushed? So you really need to think about and look at the step back and look at the bigger picture of what's going on. The tribes could fully have fished. There were crab out there. Some of them have said that they didn't see it there, but yet our commercial guys found them. They were there. They did really well. 15 crabs a pot. I just got done talking to Brian and Ken. And, you know, they can play it however they want. But it, to me, in my opinion, it's a strictly a power play. And I don't think we can commit to not standing up and gaining their respect. If we roll over and roll over and roll over, there's no end to it. Playing nice has never gotten us anywhere. I guess that's my message I want to leave today. We're your constituents. Take care of us. Thank you.
Thanks. Okay.
Yeah, I would just like to follow up on that and say that in the negotiations, I would certainly like to see a set date of return to the water as part of, I mean, if we're going to say, okay, we're moving off the water, I think we really need to be firm. I agree with Ron.
Good. Okay. Is that it then, Mr. Director?
Yes.
Okay. Well, thank you, guys.
Thank you,
Ron. Ron squared there.